Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. Perpetual Chess is brought to you through the generosity of its Patreon and PayPal supporters. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hello again, listeners, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. This week on our show, we have who I believe to be the newest Grandmaster-elect of the United States. He is 21 years old. He just got his third GM norm down in Charlotte. He is approximately the 27th highest-rated player in the U.S., also a recent college graduate. He's got degrees in economics and math from BYU. And he is a member of the San Diego Surfers of the Pro Chess League. So GM-elect Michael Brown, thank you for joining us.
You should write a biography for me. That was very good.
Thank you. I'm available. So as I was just telling you before we started recording, I mean, I follow chess pretty closely here in the U.S. as both an enthusiast and it being sort of part of my job here as a podcast host. So I've seen your name come up in the Pro Chess League, and I know you've been an ascending young player for a while. But then I saw that you got your third norm, and I saw this post that got shared a few times on Facebook thanking everyone, and it tickled my heart. So I thought that now would be a good time to have you on the show.
I appreciate it. I mean, it's been a long journey, so there's a lot of people to thank, and so the post, I don't think it quite did justice anyway, but I tried.
Yeah, well, I think you did a good job, and we'll get to some of the people who've been instrumental in your ascension. But generally, when someone's coming off of a tournament like that and it's still relatively fresh in their mind, I like to get a little recap. So you just got your third norm down in Charlotte. Can you tell us about that experience?
Sure. So fun fact about me, I came down to Charlotte, I think, North Carolina, about six times over the past 2 or 3 years. And almost every time, I got 6 out of 9. And 6 out of 9 was always a half point off from the norm. So I always felt like Charlotte was kind of my cursed city, where I would always get just that close, but not quite there. So this time around, the tournament started off well. I got 2 wins with white in the first 3 rounds. So getting +2 out of 3 rounds is very good. Then I had a couple draws in rounds 4 and 5 against players where I was actually losing both of the games, but managed to find some fortresses to hold the difficult positions. And that was something that I really liked about my play, was that despite, you know, not always playing my best games, because it's a 9-round tournament, you're going to have a bad game now and then, that I was still able to hold tough and show some resilience to make it difficult for my opponents to find the wins. And luckily for me, it just happened that they didn't find it. I feel like with Grandmaster Norms, you kind of need a little bit of luck to make it sometimes, because when you're playing the group of players I was playing, where everyone was at least International Master, and there was only one FIDE Master, but he has Gary Shanker, but he has five or six IM Norms, something like that. Everyone's good. So you do need a little bit of things to go your way. So luckily this tournament, I had those wins in the early rounds. I had a win in round six with the black pieces. And then after drawing the top two seeds of the tournament, I had to win my last round against actually Gauri Shankar. And the game was extremely tense. He decided just to play an opening that he'd never played before. So there went all my prep out the window. But it was a crazy fight. I tried to make it as unbalanced as possible. Unfortunately, you know, if I don't play well with the imbalances, then I could get a bad position. That's what happened. In fact, I was completely lost at one point. But what I did have in that game was very good time management. So despite having a completely losing position, I was up quite a bit of time. My opponent, Gauri, was getting low in a very complicated position. He missed some winning ideas. And then all of a sudden, a couple moves later, he had allowed me to consolidate, and now he was low on time and not quite winning, and so I was able to turn it around, and slowly but surely, my advantage got bigger and bigger. I took some risks that game, but eventually got the win. And so that was something that I was really fond of, because I had had many games where I needed to win my last round to make the Grandmaster Norm, and so many times I had just missed it. I'd been pushing for 4 hours, then I missed something and I drew, and this was kind of the common pattern for me for the past year and a half. But at least one time, just one time, I needed to go my way, and so this was that one time.
And when you're playing with sort of heightened stakes, I mean, you've been working for this achievement your whole career, how hard is it to block out the goal you're seeking and the fact that this is the game as compared to just a sort of regular tournament game?
Right. I'll say in the beginning that when I started going for Grandmaster Norms, it was very hard to block this out. But after a while, my rating actually crossed 2,500 when I got my first Grandmaster Norm. And so to me, it felt like, at least with the norms, all you need is a couple good tournament performances. You don't need to have you don't need to be like this super consistent player who's always doing well in every tournament. I'd already gotten that requirement. So, and it was helpful that a lot of the people I trained with, they would always comment how they always thought I was a grandmaster and just not a name yet. And so I thought, okay, you know, I just keep up what I'm doing and that's enough. So, and in this last round, to me, I think what really made a difference was that I went into the last round with the attitude that a draw and a loss, it was the same for me. And usually the pressure is like, I don't want to lose. That's one of the big problems about chess, is everybody hates losing. But when it comes to the norms, it was actually kind of a blessing in disguise, because I just figured if I lose, it's the same thing to me. I don't care. So to me, I just played, as I said, as crazy imbalanced as I could. And in some other games, I might have held back and not take as many risks. But here, I think I've got kind of used to the pressure, too, is that so many times I've had to play for the Grandmaster Norm that eventually it's like, it's not a big deal anymore. It's just time to sit down and play and treat it like a regular tournament game.
And with you mentioned that you felt like time management was a strength in this game. Do you think that the fact that you weren't really worried about losing as compared to drawing, did that help with your time management?
I will say absolutely. Usually I'm actually a pretty conservative player with my time. I like to take my time and try to find the best moves if I can and make it as difficult as I can for my opponents, obviously. But in this case, I thought, you know, since I already kind of have a feeling for what the plans are, I don't need to spend a lot of time thinking about the specifics of whether this plan works in such and such position. I just play the plan. And since I'm playing for a loss or draw, even if I play fast and it turns out I make a mistake, at least I'll have some time on my edge at the end. And the thing, too, is that when I was actually a FIDE Master, International Master, playing these Grand Masters, there are many games where I would have the upper hand against these guys. But then my time would be very low, and they would take full advantage of that, and they would muddy up the position, and all of a sudden it got very difficult, and I'd make some mistakes. I'd end up either, you know, giving up the draw or even losing the game. So in a way, I had some very bad experiences with Grandmasters using my lack of time, my lack of, you know, effectively using my time to get results that weren't deserved, specifically based on the position.
Can you think of any in particular, any that really sting?
It's been a while. I've been kind of at this level for a while now, but let me think about that just for a sec.
Okay, because we can come back to that if you want. And one thing I noticed in going through your tournament history is even though I think of you as like a young active player, I know that you've been in college the last few years. You actually haven't, aside from the Pro Chess League, which we'll also talk about, you haven't been playing all that many tournaments.
No.
So how do you stay sharp?
So when I got to school, I actually wasn't sure about how I was going to stay sharp either, but I had a couple people I knew back in Southern California, part of the community, that I knew were international masters, aspiring to become grandmasters just like me. And so I decided to give them a call and say, hey, if you think it's possible, I'd like to train with you online. I know that maybe it's, you know, you're teaching or whatever, but if we could just train for maybe an hour or so, just kind of get some ideas out there and talk about the game, then that would keep my interest in the game. And I think that actually really helped, because not only did I start that way, I started to add more training partners as school went on. And so having them, I was going to say, just having them just gave me someone else to banter with for these chess ideas. And it gave me reason to stay with the modern chess and follow it more closely. And also a reason to study chess. Studying chess by yourself takes a lot of discipline. And I will say I'm not the most disciplined studier when I'm just by myself, but when I'm with people that I know that are also at my same level, I'm challenged to, you know, keep up with everything, keep my own knowledge up. And so I think that really helped me while I was in school.
Okay, so a couple follow-ups on that. I don't know if you want to reveal your training partners or keep it private due to like opening stuff. But my main question is, what kind of stuff do you guys look at, and how do you come up with the material?
Yeah, so that's a very good question. It ranges based on the training partners. Some of my training partners, I'll mention one here because he and I we've been training for a long time. His name is Keaton Kira. He's an international master from, he's living in San Diego right now.
Yeah, manager of the Surfers, right?
That's right, the manager of the Surfers. So that might have given me the in.
Right. And, you know, any detectives listening might have guessed that one anyway, but go on.
Right. But he was actually the first training partner I had. And we had actually met at the 2015 Southern California Championship, where I met him for the first time. We played, I won the game, and I was just a FIDE master back then, but he was very impressed, and he said, let's train together. I want to like learn more about how you approach chess and vice versa. And so at first, I think we really just started going over openings, just kind of different opening ideas that were happening. But mainly what we also did was we played a lot of training games. So we just trained in different things we wanted to stick. Maybe we wanted to try out a new opening. And so we just played a quick rapid or blitz game in this opening to see how we're feeling. And sometimes we would just go over openings without even playing a game, just to kind of banter about ideas. But some of my other training partners, I did try to focus maybe on more problem solving, doing some tactics, some calculation ideas, how to attack. And so luckily I have I said 4 or 5 regular training partners over my college career. And so with each of them, there were differences in the way we trained, but I would say the main things we focused on were openings, training games, and then, you know, the tactics and puzzles, that kind of stuff.
And so would this be like a Skype group, or you train with different people separately, or some combination of the two?
Very rarely would I do more than one person at a time, just because it's hard to get so many people involved in the same call at the same time. And
as a podcast host, I can definitely relate to that.
Right. And the other thing too is a lot of these chess players I met that I trained with, I actually met during college at tournaments that I went to. So when I was a freshman, I actually went to some tournaments in Dallas. And what I noticed about Dallas is there's a lot of college-age chess players around my strength that I hadn't known before. I didn't know that there was this vibrant community of people who were striving just like me to make the Grandmaster title
were playing at
these same tournaments.
UTD students or even beyond that?
No, I think it was actually non-UTD students mainly. It was actually people that would come to UTD to play that, you know, they didn't have to just – they weren't just right there. They actually had to travel and – they seem very dedicated. So I actually met some of my training partners like that. I'll just mention another one. This is a Canadian international master who I met at a Dallas tournament. In fact, he and I roomed kind of randomly there and became pretty good friends. His name is Sham Tavandaran. He actually plays for the Montreal Chess Bras in the Pro Chess League, and he's also an aspiring international master like me.
You mean Grandmaster?
Now it's a. I have to forget that I no longer aspiring international master.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so when I say that, I just feel like it's been 2 years. But he and I met at a Dallas tournament, and then he was another guy who I noticed he was actually a little bit older than me, and that actually shocked me. He was working full time, and yet he was coming to these tournaments, and so I was actually very inspired by like his dedication to the game, despite all the other things that he had going on, because I thought school was bad. Then all of a sudden he's got almost full-time work. And so I thought, okay, if he can go to these tournaments and train, once every week, why can't I, doing college? So I think just it was those kinds of experiences and meeting those kind of people that I think really helped me, because those were good places to meet the type of people who I would train with later on.
That makes sense. And since you were training with more than one person, did it amount to more than one session per week? Or like how often did these sessions average out to?
Sure. I think there were some on times where I would train two or three sessions a week, and there were other times where I wouldn't train at all. I mean, it kind of went up and down with the seasons and school especially. Sometimes I have to call off training sessions because I had maybe like a project at school that I just need to focus on that. But I would say on average, I think once a week or maybe once every 2 weeks would be kind of the norm. Just based on, there are some very long stretches of where I just couldn't train at all just because of the business of school. In fact, my last semester of college, I didn't play any chess tournaments because I was very focused on job hunting and trying to get my career figured out at the same time. So that took me away from chess for a little bit, but I still train, I'd say, again, once every 2 weeks. And so that still kept me sharp enough.
Okay. Yeah. And you graduated just a couple months ago. Is that right?
I did. I graduated December 21st, 2018.
Okay. And what's your next step? Have you figured that out yet?
So I'm actually going to be moving out to Washington, D.C. in a month, or not in a month, in I would say 3 weeks or so, to start a job as an economic consultant. When you say the economics and math majors, economic consultant is actually a pretty good mix of those two. So I'll be headed out to D.C. to a firm called Bates White. And I'll be starting there, at the end of the month. So I'm really excited for that. Also, a little nervous because it's a full-time role. And I will say that getting the Grandmaster norm when I did, extremely, it was a very good time to get it because, man, if I had not gotten it here, I would have had to probably find some time during my job to play. And that's tough. So,
yeah, well, congratulations on the job, first of all.
Well, thank you.
And yeah, definitely good timing. I mean, just speaking from my experience, not playing on your level, but finding some time to compete, I think would not, if you decide to make it a priority, it's definitely, it's not impossible when you're working full time. Just don't have kids is my advice.
I'm 21. I probably have some years ahead.
Good, good. I mean, I've obviously in due time is a life experience I recommend, but not, it doesn't, won't be good for your chess. do you think you'll do any coaching or are you just going to focus on your work for the time being?
That's actually a question I'm pondering. right now. The thing is, I don't know the DC community very well at the moment. What I'm going to do is I'm going to try to arrive early and maybe go to a couple chess clubs, scout out the kind of players that are there, the kind of people who might be interested in coaching or whatnot. And so we'll see. I mean, it's not something I've done a lot in the past, to be honest. I've really focused on my competitive chess. And so coaching was something that always took a back seat there. But that might be something worthwhile considering when I, you know, start the full-time job, because playing competitive chess is going to be a lot harder then.
Yeah, and you can, if you find dedicated young students, it's sort of a, you know, it's a way that you can still live a bit vicariously through a student who's really pushing hard to improve, even if you don't have the time to do it yourself. And I was just going to say, like, I saw you've done a couple YouTube videos, and I would definitely encourage you. You're very good at explaining ideas.
So you encourage me to get on there more, huh?
Well, if you have the time, or at least to do teaching. I'm just saying however you decide to pursue it, you're good at explaining ideas. And one of the videos I saw was your video highlighting beating Yu Yang Yi. With the black pieces, no less, just sort of a mind-boggling achievement. So I'll link to the whole video in the show description. But why don't you if you could tell our listeners just sort of the Cliff Notes version of what this experience was like?
Sure. So Yu Yang Yi was the first full Super Grandmaster I played, and it was at Chicago Open 2016, round two. I had played down the first round and won, and I expected, you know, I'd probably play down again round two, and the parents come in, and there's Yu Yang Yi.
If I could just jump in for a second, just for any listener who doesn't know, Yu Yang Yi is currently number 12 in the world. He was top 20 even then, one of China's best players, so just an absolute monster. But anyway, sorry, go on.
So, I mean, yes, I actually had a roommate, Grandmaster Yaroslav Zherobuk, who was staying with us at the time, and I remember he even expressed some trepidation over Yu Yang Yi's participation in the tournament.
Right, yeah.
I mean, I was thinking, like, and I respect Yaro. He's a very strong Grandmaster. I think he's going for a MBA or something right now at St. Louis University. But I remember, like, when I heard that from, like, a guy like Yaro, I thought, oh, geez. What's going to happen? You know, I'm probably going to get, you know, destroyed. But to be honest, at the same time, playing a guy that high, it takes some of the pressure off too, because you're not expected to win. You're not even expected to draw. I mean, there's only one result that's expected, and being black, you know, in the game, it's like, well, okay, I guess I can just kind of play because there's no pressure on me to hold up to any expectations, even if I lose. I'm not, no one's going to think like, oh, geez, I can't believe Michael lost to Yu Yang Yi.
Right.
It's like, it's just one of those things that I think for me, at least psychologically, playing the top players is actually something I actually enjoy doing, just because it takes the pressure off of having to perform like with the results, like I need to get the win or I need to get the draw. No longer is it thinking about the results, it's just thinking about, let's just play a game of chess and figure out what happens. Me versus him. He's probably good, but you know what? I mean, if we just play him versus me and he beats me, that's fine, fair and square. He's a very good chess player. No one's going to think any different of me. And so I think that was a very good psychological way to view the game. So the game started. Of course, I think he had a little jet lag. I mean, he's from China, and he was playing in the U.S. for, I think it was one of his first tournaments in the U.S. I think he'd only played two or three beforehand. And so I thought I could say, since he was a little bit tired, but he's still playing fine. But he did make a mistake in the middle game that allowed me to make the position kind of unclear. And unfortunately for me, I made some mistakes myself. And at one point, he actually offered me a draw. He pushed he was white, and he pushed his pawn at h6. He played h6 check, where I had like a king on g7 and the h7, g6, f7 structure and offered a draw. Now, normally when a person pushes their pawn at h6, it's not a good sign, especially if you don't have your dark squared bishop to cover those weak squares. But the fact that he had offered me a draw kind of shocked me, because I was thinking, here's this guy who is one of the top players in the world. I'm just a FIDE master, and he's offering me a draw. with the white pieces. Something is going on. He must not really like his position very much. And so I decided, you know what, I'm just going to play it out. I'm going to see what happens. It doesn't seem like he's very comfortable. And, you know, when I offer draws, I offer draws usually when I'm not comfortable with the position. And so I thought, there's no way that a Super Grandmaster would offer a draw to someone as low as me without some trepidation about his position. So I decided I'll play on. And I think the position, it actually shocked both me when I did it. Like, when I played on, I was a little shocked. I was like, oh, why didn't I take the draw? You fool!
Right.
But at the same time, I think it really shocked him. I think he expected, no, here's this 2400 FM. I just offered him a draw. There's no way. No way he doesn't take it. I'm one of the top players in the world. And I decided, I'll just play him like a human being. It's like, I know he's one of the best players in the world, but just for that moment to make that decision, I'd say I'm treating him like a regular human who's not comfortable with the position, and so we'll play on. And it also helped me because I think he might have got a little mad. And so when we played on, he had a chance to go for a repetition. He actually had a repetition at hand, but he didn't go for it. He tried to play on for the win. And, you know, it caused me, it was a pretty interesting position. And he had a couple ways to draw, but I think he was so focused on trying to beat me at that point that I think he was kind of overlooked all these draws to try to find the win. Unfortunately for him, no such win existed in the position, so he ended up trying to have to hold a worse endgame. And unfortunately, I think he also got kind of low on time. It was one of the longest games of the round, and I felt that, you know what, I'm up a pawn in this endgame. I was going to keep playing, and see what happens. And eventually I managed to create a mating net around his king, after which he did resign. And so 60-move game against Super GM that went my way. Yeah, it was definitely something I was not expecting. And I got a lot of people were watching that game, and it was something that, it's not very often you get to play a Super Grandmaster, first of all. And so the fact that I even got to play Yu Ying Yi was quite the experience. But the fact that, you know, I get to play him and go for the win and then eventually did win, that's even rarer. So I think I just try to make the most of my opportunities in the game. Just play regular chess. Don't worry about the result. I think if I'd been more worried about the result, I would have taken the draw, no questions asked. I mean, it was unclear when he offered the draw anyway. But I decided, no, I'm going to play this on and just see what happens. And so that attitude allowed me to get some of this fantastic result.
Yeah, and it's a great lesson in sort of chess psychology. I mean, it's impressive that even when you were 18 or 19, however old you mm-hmm. were during mm-hmm. that game, that you had the perspective, sort of poker player mentality, that, hold on, if he's offering a draw here, he doesn't think he's better. And just for listeners, again, I'll try to link to the game, although I have to say, Michael, I watched your YouTube video, and then I tried to look for the game on chessgames.com and didn't see it.
Yeah, I think the game is on Chess Tempo. I believe they have it on that database. But yeah, like, if you just search it up, I also was unable to find it. I'm not sure maybe if he asked the database to hide it or something. But
yeah, that's funny. And I'll check ChessBase as well. I mean, we'll get the game out there for sure. Obviously, you're not hiding it, being that there's a YouTube video on it and being that it's mm-hmm. a crowning achievement. But yeah, I mean, getting back to the psychology, it's really impressive. I mean, it shows a great deal of confidence for a young FM to have the presence to sort of look through the situation. And it was not a playing for two results type position. It was a, like, what mm-hmm. the hell is going on here type position.
Yeah. So, yes.
So yeah, it's congratulations. And you mentioned in that video you've played a couple other Super GMs.
I have.
So who else?
So I played Luke McShane when he was about 2690, and I know he's been a Super GM before, and that was actually the first Super GM I ever played. And in fact, similarly, I got like a good position versus him, but I think I did get kind of too involved with the details of the result. And so with a better position, I kind of just quickly panicked and collapsed. And it was, I mean, again, he was the top seed of the event that of the tournament I was playing in, but still it was like, geez, you know, I had a good position, you know, like I was doing very well. And then I just allowed him to get a free point. I've also played, Santosh Gujarati Vidit from India.
Oh, yeah,
he's
yeah.
another Super Grandmaster
yeah,
I played.
He's been on this show. Super nice guy.
Yeah, no, we had a very, very nice post-mortem, even despite losing to him. It was a very interesting game, and he was giving me a lot of ideas. And yeah, I was very impressed by the way that he played. And though, like, I think I actually did have a draw at one point, you know, despite that, it's like these Super Grandmasters, they're something else when they're on their form.
Yeah.
So I got to play Vidit, and then I believe the only other one I got to play was Zoltan Almasi. So,
and you won that one, right?
I did win that one. That was actually for Grandmaster Norm as well. I tend to make my Grandmaster Norm super high caliber, very scary.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want the games. Haters to be casting doubt on the Norm, so
right. But the reason why and most of those games, actually, both Vidit and Almasi, they actually came when I played in the Isle of Man International in 2017. And what I'll mention about some of those Europe tournaments is, gosh, the caliber of the players that go there on average is far different from a lot of the U.S. tournaments. In the U.S., usually your top seed will be about 2650, 2670 if you're lucky. Maybe 2700. You might get a guy like Lequang Liam, for example, to play in an event in the U.S. But very rarely do you have a tournament in the U.S. where you have the top 10 seeds are all Super Grandmasters. The next 20 are all 2650 plus Grandmasters. And as a 2499 International Master at that tournament, I barely made the top half of the tournament. So that was something where I was shocked to be in such an event where I actually played up, I think, six times. I played six Grandmasters, and almost every time they were at least 2,600. And so that gave me a very good experience to play these Super Grandmasters, and also just Grandmasters who were playing chess professionally. What I like to say to people if they're thinking about trying to go for Norms is the U.S. is a very hard country to get Norms in, just because it's most people there are usually just as hungry for the Norms as you are, and so the games will be very, very difficult, and the schedule usually is also very grueling, whereas in Europe you play usually it's once a day and you get a lot more chances to play those top caliber Grandmasters. And so if anybody out there is always thinking about trying to go for GM Norms, I would recommend going to Europe, despite the fact that I got two of my Norms in the U.S., but I'll say those were not easy.
Yeah, I mean, we're lucky to have Charlotte and St. Louis hosting a few more of these Norm events now, but I know that historically Europe has been the place to go, and certainly per capita, even though the U.S. is ascendant, it's hard to compete with the sort of concentrated chess power that Europe has.
Yeah.
So you mentioned I was creeping on your Facebook page in preparation for this interview. So
I'm just like, uh-oh.
Yeah. Well, I luckily it seems to be all chess. You're on your best behavior there. So, but I saw that you mentioned meeting a couple of your chess heroes in Isle of Man. So, and you had a picture of yourself with Magnus. So what were the experiences away from the board like at that tournament?
Yeah, that was a very interesting experience in general. I remember I actually showed up to the tournament. They were having the opening ceremony, and some of my roommates were thinking, why would we go to the opening ceremony? You know, it's just them drawing the lots. And I was thinking, but it's not just people drawing lots. It's Magnus Carlsen, it's Vishy Anand, it's Vladimir Kramnik, Fabi Caruana. They're the one drawing the odds. And it was like the first time I'd ever seen any of them face-to-face. So I was... It's like I got to go to this opening ceremony. And so that was the first time where I got to see the top 10 seeds lined up. And man, I was like, man, I've seen so many games of these guys in print, right, where they just play phenomenal chess. And here they are just in the flesh, just looking like normal human beings, just having a good time, you know, and just picking lots and, you know, talking to each other, joking. And I thought, wow, that's pretty neat, you know, that you see their fire on the chessboard, but off the chessboard, a lot of these guys, they're somewhat social, some of course more than others, but they're, you know, at the opening ceremony, I could see that. I also I took a risk at one point during the tournament. I think it was round seven or something. I saw Vishyanand, former world champion Vishyanand, just kind of walk by. He had just finished a tough game of his. And I'd actually met Mr. Anand at a camp in California, in Los Angeles, about 7 years ago. There's a organization called Metropolitan Chess that, unfortunately, now I don't think they're not really doing that much anymore for chess. I think the owner maybe moved on to something else. But back in those days, they were hosting huge internationals. They've had Anand, Aronian, and Wesley So come to camps to teach.
Wow.
And I just happened to be at the ones where I got to meet both. I got to meet Wesley So, and I got to meet Anand. And so I went up to him, you know, after the round and said, "Hey, Mr. Anand, I don't know if you remember me. I was one of the kids that was at the LA camp." And he was very cordial and friendly. He said, "Hello, you know, yes, I remember. How are you?" I'd actually drawn Anand a couple of times in the simuls as well.
Oh, cool.
So I think that might have made maybe he remembered me more from that too. But, you know, I just had a pleasant 2-minute, 3-minute conversation with him just about my goals, where I was going, and also just about him a little bit. And I thought, wow, that's awesome. I just talked to one of the, just 4 years ago, this guy was the world champion, and he's still one of the top players in the world. And I just talked to him like he's just another guy. And so in the closing ceremony, you know, there's all these pictures being taken and the speeches and all that. And it seems so formal. And I'd always seen press conferences of the guys doing it. But then what you never see is that after the press conference, all the guys, they just go back to playing chess, but this time with like beers in their hand.
Right.
So that was something I didn't know. So there's like on one side of the room, there's Nakamura, who was playing, I believe it was Lawrence Trent, with some time odds. I think it was like 4 minutes to 45 seconds. It's pretty hilarious.
Yeah, unbelievable.
And on the other side, you could see some of the Norwegian guys playing Bughouse. And I thought, what the heck? These guys play Bughouse?
Right.
And there's like Nihal Sarin and Pragananha, two of the youngest Indian prodigies. They're just playing Bullet. And I'm just like, wow. Like, even after the tournament's over, they're still all just very interested in chess. And now they're just having fun. They're drinking. They're having a good time. During the tournament, they're all competitors. But here, you know, they act a lot like, you know, just people who, despite being rivals, they share a love for the game of chess. And I think that really inspired me, was to see even these guys at the top levels, despite what I feel like is immense preparation that they have to do for every game and every tournament that they play, they're still enjoying the game and still finding ways to try to enjoy the game. And so that gave me, you know, some courage to go up to Magnus Carlsen. I went up to him after the ceremony had ended. He was watching, of course, his Norwegian buddies. And I just kind of first said, "Magnus, congratulations." And then I'll be honest, I became a little bit of a fanboy. After that, he also said congratulations to me for getting the Grandmaster Norm. And I just went, can I take a picture? You know, it's just one of those. It was an awkward conversation stopper. I think Magnus, in a way, was trying to just like have an interesting conversation. But then I was just like, sorry. I mean,
yeah, you got to do it.
Carlsen.
Yeah,
I need a picture. And so he was like, okay, sure. And we took the picture. And that's what you see on Facebook, was that picture. And then, you know, we shook hands and I went off, and I was like, I went back to like some of my American buddies. I'm like, "Guys, did you see that? I took a picture with the world champion." And they're like, "Yeah, we saw, you know."
The stars are just like us. But
yeah.
But I mean,
go ahead. No, that's exactly right.
But I was going to say, I mean, of course, a lot of people listening would feel that way, especially now that you have the GM title. They see you at a tournament and they feel the same way. So, I mean, and it's you know, and it's notable that both Anand and Carlsen, at least, like, they knew who you were. So that speaks volumes about what you've achieved.
Yeah, it was pretty touching, just especially I think Carlsen, he knew because I'd gone up and I'd actually taken my Grandmaster Norm, and so he knew I just won the award. But Anand was, yeah, that was pretty touching. That he remembered the camp, and then he remembered, I'm sure there were many kids who took pictures with him. That was one of the main, you know, events of that camp. And then here's the one who drew him in the simul or whatever. And so maybe that maybe left an impression on him. So yeah, I'm, like you say, these guys, they did remember me despite me even back then just being maybe a master or an expert or something. So that was really something, that was something special.
Yeah, well, I mean, the stories about Anand are that he remembers everything. So I guess not so surprising that that even at camp many years ago, he's going to remember the details.
Yeah.
So you mentioned these guys inspiring you, and in the sort of the Facebook note that I mentioned earlier, you mm-hmm. gave a shout out to your former coach, Armin Armbatsumian. I mm-hmm. hope I said his name like somewhat resembling the correct way, but I mean, well-known Southern California trainer.
Yes.
And so I was curious, you mentioned he helped you in difficult times. So I was curious, what were the difficult times for you in your chess career?
Yeah, that's a very good question. One that I hate to revisit, but one that it did really change how I view chess. So I'll say the first big kind of dark age for me was I reached expert at age 11. And when I was, 11, I thought I was going to just become a master straight away. I was improving rapidly. Armin was my coach then, and I was having good tournament. But then I hit a little snag in the latter end of 2009. I went to a couple international tournaments. I did very poorly. And in general, even back in the U.S., I was starting to do poorly for about 8 months or so. And I didn't know what had happened. I thought I was this 2100, and all of a sudden I'd lost 100 points and was having very average results. But my coach, Armin, he told me to stick through it, that despite the fact that maybe my results weren't quite there, I was still learning, still growing, and that this is just a little plateau for now. But if I just kept on working hard, that I would eventually go past. I also had some very intense conversations with my parents too, because man, sometimes when you play chess, you're just not doing well. You just think this game, I'm just no good at it. I'm never going to get better. I can't win such and such game, and I do bad at every tournament. What's the point? And so these are the kind of thoughts that were going through my mind. But I just kept on sulking through for a little bit because it was very hard to play and study. And then in 2010, I went to Vegas for the National Open, and that was actually when I had a breakthrough, at least for that first dark age. I managed to win the tournament, the under 2200 section, and all of a sudden, I think that one result caused me to, all my confidence was just like, okay, that's right. I can still play chess well. I just need to make sure everything's in gear. I need the confidence back and not to be worried too much about the results, all this stuff psychologically.
Get a little money for that too, right?
I did. I won one of my biggest paychecks. I won $3,000 for that as a
11-year-old.
I believe I was 12 years old at that time. But so that was something that I was like, gee, that was awesome. But that didn't mean that was the end of it. I had another, in high school, especially a dark age, I think for 2 or 3 years, I didn't cross 2400 USCF. I was kind of stuck at the 2300 range. And part of it was that, high school, you're doing a lot of work there, and I wasn't studying as much as I should have. But then again, my coach and my parents, they pushed me to continue playing, and just that eventually things will get better as long as I put in the work. That's the first thing you got to do is you got to put in the work. You got to go to the tournaments. You got to play. I mean, if you do those three, eventually things will hopefully turn around. And so after 2 years of kind of meandering around the 2300s, I did have some good tournaments and eventually crossed 2400. I made my first IM norm. And once I made that, I thought, okay, I think I can keep going because here's like a benchmark where I made my first IM norm. Now I think I could set a new goal of becoming an international master, and then after that, new goal becoming a grandmaster, and so on. And so I think the main thing about those dark periods was that despite not having the best results, I was still practicing, I was still learning, and I was still trying to have a genuine interest in the game, doing everything that the guys who had come before me told me to do, because they're experts in the game. And I realize now that their encouragement, it meant a lot to me then, and now where I'm at, I just realize I couldn't have done it without, you know, the support of people like that, to who just pushed me along and let me know that there is a long-term perspective to this, that just a couple bad months or even a bad year doesn't mean that you're not going to improve at chess. So
that's great advice. And I'm sure to a lot of listeners, like the rating plateaus that you describe sound kind of like first world problems, you know, like getting stuck at 2400 or getting stuck trying to break through 2400 and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I think that the lessons that you're describing are applicable to anyone. And I know we have a lot of adult listeners who, you know, I mean, myself included, who probably will never see 2100, but the lessons of knowing that there's going to be good periods and bad periods definitely apply to everyone. So speaking of chess improvement, so what have been the most effective learning tools for you, whether it be books or online training or formative lessons you've gotten over the years?
Sure. So when I was a younger kid, just starting out chess, there were a couple of things that I loved to do. Number one was reading books. And one series that really stuck out to me was Grandmaster Yasser Sarawan's Winning Chess series. There were 7 books in that series. And as a young kid, I really liked the way he approached chess and like just explained the game. And in a way, he just kind of made it fun. You had this one book that's called Winning Chess Brilliancies. And he goes through almost every move, having a note by each and every move from all these great players. It could be world champions, it could be some grandmasters playing, but to me it just fostered a love for the game. It's like, wow, this is what can happen if you like you keep sticking with chess and you can play some of these brilliancies. So that chess series, especially when I was starting out, was very helpful.
So do you remember approximately what rating you were?
I think I started reading these at age 7, and I didn't even start playing USCF tournaments until I was age 8. But I don't think I stopped reading them until maybe I was 9.5, 10, when I reached maybe 1700.
Okay, wow.
Because at that point, I realized that despite, you know, the awesome games and whatever, I knew them all by heart, for one. So that wasn't very helpful, you know, like I already knew it all. So I'd read it and go, yeah, I already knew that. But there were also a lot of other books out there that maybe were more applicable to my level then. So that was something I did. The other thing I did as a starting out was that I played online chess almost incessantly, nonstop. I would just go online after school. I'd come home from school. I had an ICC account. My dad had created it for me. It's my ICC account is Michael Q to D5. My chess.com is Michael Q to D5. My Yahoo is Michael Q. Like, it's just like this thing that. And here's the history of how that name came to be. When I was 7 years old, my dad just had a simple question. Michael, where's your favorite square to move the queen? And as a 7-year-old, I just said, D5. And so all of a sudden, Michael Q to D5. That's what it means, queen to D5. Nice. The handle was born. And so, you know, that was the history of that. And I would just go online after school. I would play for hours, literally hours. I wouldn't stop. I'd play they used to have the 2-minute, 12-second increment time controls. And I would play game after game in that time control. And I have some of those games still saved in my archive. And let me tell you, those games were not good quality at all.
Right.
Terrible quality. I'm looking at it, it's like, what was I thinking? You know, now, of course, like, even when I'm 1700, I think, what am I thinking? But, like, back then, it was a blunder after blunder after blunder by each side. Hanging piece here and hanging piece there. But despite all that, I think I just really loved playing the game.
And was it mostly blitz?
It was mostly blitz.
And were you reviewing the games or just plowing game to game?
I think there were a couple games where I'd go back and review them. But to be honest, as a 7-year-old, you're not really – it's hard to think long term as a 7-year-old.
Yeah, so. No, I mean, I'm asking mostly as a coach's perspective. I know that you weren't like, you probably weren't like super regimented at that age, but I always wonder just as a coach, like if the kids love chess, which is the most important thing, and they're playing, that's obviously good. But on the other hand, it's like, how hard should I be pushing them to be doing tactics instead, you know?
Yeah, I will say that at that point in my life, my first coach, his name is FIDE Master Takashi Iwamoto. He was part of this organization called Academic Chess that, in addition to these online blitz tournaments, I'd also get to play Friday night tournaments with other kids around my age. It wasn't USCF rated, but they did use like a rating system. And so this organization, I played that also in second grade as well. And so at least at the beginning, I think that's what really helped me was just playing chess with kids online, basically whenever I could, to be honest. I felt like whenever I had free time as a kid, I'd be the first thing I want to do would go on ICC, play some blitz. I didn't care if I won, lost, drew, whatever. I just want to play some chess. So that really helped me at the beginning. Later on, I'd say when after once I reached, you know, 1700, class B, class A, that's when I really started to focus on, I need to get my tactics up, I need to get my openings up, all this defense, whatever. And so I did actually, I saw that there's a note that another grandmaster recommended this program called CT Art.
Yeah, Mauricio Flores.
Yeah. And I also say like him, I did those a lot when I got to the class B, class A level. I started to do those quite a bit. And so those were very helpful for at least getting my pattern recognition up for the types of tactics that you see in regular chess. And chess.com, I don't think, was really big back then. So these were the kind of programs you got to use. But then when I finally got to get Coach Armin Ambartsumian, once he finally became my coach, we started having face-to-face lessons once a week. And I'll say that was actually very helpful in that it gave me no excuses to not put my best effort in, because my dad would drive me to Long Beach, which is about a 40-minute drive from where I live, to meet with a coach for an hour and a half. And so if I don't put in my best, I'm not going to be going to lessons very long. Right. So that gave me some, I think, gave some motivation to really focus on what he was trying to teach me. And so that really helped me when I was, you know, struggling as an expert or as a master to go to these things and have an hour and a half just to discuss chess and do these puzzles. And, that was very effective. And then of course, we talked about this a little bit at the beginning, was that once I got to college, the training partners, to me, that was the biggest thing that really helped my game, just because it kept my interest in the game very high. It exposed me to people around my level that were just as interested in chess as I was, and had their own strengths and weaknesses. And now all of a sudden I could banter back and forth with them. And so it depends on the level. I think at different levels, different things work. So I would, yeah. So it was a lot. I know I said a lot about all the things that really helped me, but
no, that's great. And a lot of it, you know, a lot of it is stuff that's often recommended, which I think is good because, it shows that there is a clear path, especially stuff like finding training partners. I mean, that's something that's kind of easy to overlook because chess can be such a solitary game. But
yeah,
but I mean, it helps to have someone hold you accountable and someone to bounce ideas off of.
Yeah.
So you also mentioned in the Facebook post that when you went to college, you factored your goal of becoming a grandmaster as a big component.
And absolutely.
So what's the connection between your going to Brigham Young and your then goal of becoming a grandmaster?
So, yeah. These are things that on social media, it's hard to put this all out there because then your post would be way too long and no one would read it. But I'll say that for college, I'd heard a lot of, I wouldn't call them horror stories, but kind of, I don't know if you've heard these stories before, but basically, there's a guy who's very good at chess. He did well in his younger years, but once he gets to college, he'll go to a really good college, but he won't be able to pursue chess very much. And in a couple of years, he pretty much just gives up chess completely.
Are you thinking, I've definitely heard that story, but are you thinking of someone in particular, or you're just saying that's a common narrative?
I mean, I'll say that a lot of the people in my Southern California community, my chess community, that were a little bit older than I was and were former students of Armin's, I noticed that a lot of them had kind of trailed off chess as soon as they maybe reached even high school or something where they really focused on school. And so, and I, of course, heard about this in college. So hearing that from people that I knew personally, that I looked up to as a kid, kind of shocked me. I thought, wow, here's this kid, here's this student or this person that I knew as a younger man, as a younger boy, that I was thinking this guy is one of the best players in this area, and now he quit chess because he's going to college. I thought, well, geez, that seems kind of a waste. I mean, it's okay, you're going to go for a career and all that, but at the same time, I thought chess to me at least meant more than something that I just give up in college. So I got accepted to a couple very prestigious universities, like, say, UC Berkeley was one, UCLA, Cornell.
And the UCs are no joke when you live in California.
Right. And so these are places that I was very heavily considering because they have very good programs. Pretty much everyone in my school was trying to get into these similar schools as well. But I really had this goal that I wanted to make Grandmaster, especially before I started, you know, working full time, because I knew as soon as I do that, that it's going to be a lot harder to pursue that goal. And so what was good about BYU was, number one, is that it was pretty cheap. BYU, especially if you're part of the Mormon faith, they have a pretty good discount for students who decide to go there. And so that was something that really helped me. And also, BYU isn't the most prestigious university. It's still very good, but it's not as – you're not, like, quite worked to the brim like you maybe are at Cornell or UC Berkeley. Those guys – those schools really work you out, whereas at BYU, it's – the atmosphere, they take a little easier, but it's still very, very competitive programs. So I thought, okay, here's a school where I could go – for a huge fraction of the cost that I would go to a normal university, and also university where I won't have to, like, be so focused on school as much while I'm there. And those two things together made me think, okay, now I got some, then I could save some money just for chess and hopefully pursue that and be able to study chess while in school. And so those were kind of the two main factors that made me decide to go to Brigham Young University in Provo. And it worked out, you know.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say. Yeah,
it worked out, but you know, there are definitely times while I was there where I thought, man, maybe Utah is not the place for me. I mean, I'm a guy from Southern California, and the culture in Utah is a lot different, so I never fully, you know, assimilated into their culture. So there are times where I thought, man, I'm not having the greatest time, but at least I got to play chess, you know, once every month, once every 2 months. And that to me was enough.
And you got a great job too. So
yeah,
worked out in all regards. Did you have any thoughts of going to one of the chess colleges?
Not particularly, actually. I think back, you know, if I really want to pursue the Grandmaster title, you would think obviously the first thing you do is consider a chess school. But despite having this goal become a Grandmaster, I still did really want to balance my school and chess, you know, goals. And so I thought with the chess schools, they might have mandatory trainings. I've heard that sometimes you need to, there's certain regimens that they require of their students. And, they also require you to play a lot of tournaments, maybe more than I would have, you know, by myself decided to play. And so I heard some stuff like that and decided I'm not quite sure I want to go that route just because maybe there's too much emphasis on the chess. I think I like the more independent route, which is like I play chess when I think I should. I play the tournaments I want to play. I room with the people I want to room, you know, that kind of stuff. And so that to me just made more sense than going to a chess school. And I know they have great reputations, absolutely. And they've made their fair share of international masters to grandmasters and all that stuff. I think I just was also wanting to make sure that I didn't just go full chess. That was not a goal of mine when I started college, was that I never really wanted to be a professional chess player until maybe I figure out that maybe I don't want to work full time. Maybe then I'll think about it.
Yeah.
But that's not something that I was really pursuing with chess. It's just something that I just love to do, and something that I had fun doing. And it's, so to be honest, I wasn't, it's almost like when you play professionally, there is a certain fear that perhaps that kind of love, that unadulterated love for chess, kind of gets tainted with the fact that now you're trying to play for money, and so that might make people start to hate chess. And I've heard actually a lot of the students at these chess universities, starting to hate chess because they have to play it all the time, even when they don't want to.
Right.
I think that was kind of the problem for me that I was anticipating, was that, you know, I still love to play, but I don't want to have to play, like, even, you know, there'll be days where I don't want to play, and I don't want to have to be forced to play. So that also factored in. So, yeah, that was one of the main reasons.
Sounded like you had pretty good perspective for an 18-year-old in terms of knowing what you wanted and getting it. So congratulations on that. So Michael, one more topic if you're up for it.
Sure.
Greg Shahadi, of course, won't bother to listen to this, but somehow he would he would still send his henchmen after me if we didn't talk about the Pro Chess League. So so we got to talk some San Diego Surfers. What's going on this year?
First I'll give a little background about the Surfers in general, is that 2 years ago when the league started, San Diego was a new team. Of course, everyone was new then, but we had just kind of come over from the U.S. Chess League, where the SoCal community was actually kind of fractured at that point. You know, the problem with the U.S. Chess League, I think, was that one of the requirements is that everyone had to play at the same location. And, you know, that had caused a lot of, because SoCal is a very big area, and so it really limited the players that could actually play in the Chess League. But what we liked about the Pro Chess League is you could play wherever you are. And so for the first 2 years, we did very well. We got to the playoffs both of our first years. In fact, we won the Pacific Division in 2018. And the first year, we were the only team to go 5 wins, 0 losses. We had a perfect record after 5 weeks. And so this is kind of like the legacy that we've had. This year, I think what kind of happened is that, to be honest, a lot of our team, we had some very good performances in the last 2 years where we had some players who really overperformed. And this year, unfortunately, we have one player, Joshua Shang, who's been playing pretty good rapid chess. But for the rest of the team, me included, no one has really impressed thus far. So it's not like we're playing way below our rating. And so, like, for me, for instance, I think my performance is probably after the their Super Saturday version, Battle Royale.
Right.
I didn't have a very good Battle Royale. And so maybe my performance is a little bit worse, but even our top board, Drea, we're performing exactly where we are, kind of. But unfortunately for this year, no team is bad, especially in our division. Our division is full of very strong teams who almost all of them have some super grandmaster somewhere. And to be honest, we actually got hit with, in our first 2 weeks, we got hit with two teams that used like a triple grandmaster lineup. So like we played Seattle week one, where they had Ikaru, they had Mikolevsky, they had Georgi Margavashvili. And those guys are all very solid grandmasters, especially Ikaru, one of the best. And, you know, sometimes things just don't go your way. So right now, San Diego Surfers, our results aren't too great, but we are still very optimistic that in a couple of weeks we'll be able to figure out, you know, the winning lineup, you know. I'll say, as my participation for the Pro Chess League, I don't think I'll be honest, the Pro Chess League, I feel a lot of pressure when I'm playing for my team.
I don't
blame
you, yeah.
It feels like, not only am I playing for myself, I'm trying to play for my team. And so there's this added pressure, like, man, now I need to perform well. Like, if I don't win or if I don't draw, whatever, then my team is not going to do well. And unfortunately, just for us, the usually in the past couple of years, maybe one teammate wouldn't do so well, but then another one would pick up the slack, you know? Unfortunately, that hasn't quite happened this year, where it seems like everyone is kind of performing on performing averagely. It's kind of the idea there. This was happening. So, but to be honest, I think I really shouldn't take this Pro Chess League as seriously as that. The Pro Chess League is what I think I should view it as. It's more of just like it's a fun alternative to classical chess. Classical chess, you know, you're really trying to make all the correct moves. It's not a spectator sport. Moves are slow. Games take a long time, right? And so what I think the Pro Chess League is, it's a way to get the fans involved, to get, you know, chess spectators really loving to watch the game. And honestly, I think I should have more of this perspective that, you know what, Pro Chess League is just kind of something I do to have a good time, spend time with my teammates, to prepare, and just to play some fun chess in Rapid, you know, playing people all around the world. I mean, How often do I get to play, you know, Hikaru Nakamura, or maybe I actually got a rematch Yu Yang Yi. Unfortunately, game didn't go quite so well, but I'll say it's Rapid, so I'm gonna say it doesn't count. and then here in the Pro Chess League, I mean, you get to play all kinds of high-caliber players for a team. And so despite, you know, maybe the Surferage not having the best year, I think all of us are still really enjoying the experience. And, I mean, it's awesome that's a thing like this exists, where we can just take all these players from because a lot of the players of the San Diego Surfers, they don't live in SoCal anymore. A lot of them have moved out because of college. Me, I had college and now I'll have the job. But we all have some tie to the Southern California area. And so that, I think, really helps foster in, you know, the SoCal chess community. Just we're all in it together. And hopefully things will go better the second half of the season. So because we've done pretty well the first 2 years. So I think this year is more just sometimes things just don't go your way, to be honest. And like I say, with the Grandmaster Norm, I had many games where, you know, things just I press and press and press. And chess is a hard game. It just it really is a hard game.
And there is an element of luck, I would say. I mean,
sometimes you'll get lucky with maybe your opponent makes a mistake or they play into something that you studied before. It's that, like those kind of things. So with the pro, it's a tough league, but I think honestly, I need to take more of a approach that it's just kind of a fun way to play chess more than anything else with the team. It's not like even the Battle Royale, $500 I think was the top prize for the Battle Royale this last week if you won first, but you know, it's not like you're there for the money. The money is not the main thing driving people to Pro Chess League. At least I wouldn't hope.
Yeah.
I would think it's more just here's a chance to, you know, be with a team of people, hopefully around your area that you know well and share some background with. And it's just time for you guys to enjoy playing and just it's a team sport. And so just because I don't do well doesn't mean like the team, you know, despises me or anything like that, right? And so I think that's kind of the perspective I need more to focus on because, yeah, I like I said, if not, there's that extra pressure to perform, and man, does it take a toll to try to perform at some level?
Yeah, it's not worth it if you're going to beat yourself up like that.
Yeah.
But Tatyov and Melikachian have been amongst my favorite guests, so I'm definitely rooting for you guys to turn it around. Good people on that team.
Well, we'll do our best. And if things don't work out, things don't work out. But hey, we're gonna give it our all.
Cool. Glad to hear it. All right. Well, Michael, is there anything else we need to discuss before I let you go? People know how to contact you. Queen to D5. I'll put your chess.com profile up there. Is there anything else I should link to?
The Michael Q to D5, right, that's going to be that's both my Yahoo and Gmail account. If they want to send me an email, that's my chess.com account. So those are kind of the probably if you I get a lot of messages from people on chess.com, you know, they say, hey, you want to play me? And I go, well, not really, but but like I get a lot of messages there. I would say the best way though is via email, to be honest. That's I check that most regularly, and usually those aren't the places where people just say just play me. So
yeah,
I think that's okay. Best form for that.
So listeners, keep it substantive, but if you need to reach him, you can.
Yeah, and just remember, guys, if you're having a tough time, I mean, there's several things you can do, and that it gets better. I think that's one of the main things about my story is that my role the Grandmaster was not all rainbows and sunshine. Far from it. There are so many times where I wanted to quit. I was hating myself. My confidence was low. But you got to just say, you know what? It's just life. Life can be tough sometimes, and you'll have your ups and downs. But you got to remember that there will be an up at some point.
That's great perspective, and I think a good note to end on. So Michael, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. That includes my producer, Matthew Passy, and Geert Vandervelt for supplying the intro music. I also want to thank all of you who have helped spread the word about the show. That includes people who tell your friends and write positive reviews on Apple Podcasts or other platforms. Every little bit helps. But most of all, I want to thank the people who provide financial support. As you guys have heard me say, I spend a lot of time on this show, about 5 hours a week, and even though it's my favorite aspect of the work that I do, I would not be able to do all this without financial support. So most of all, I want to thank my Patreon and PayPal perpetual partners. They are Chessable.com, Ace Vallega, Adam Ralph of ChessEngland.com, Adam Vrancourge, Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Benjamin Handelman, Brian Castro of BetterChessTraining.com, Bill Moran, Brett Howard Lynn, Brian Mullis, I am Carlos Perdomo of ChessAtlanta.com, Chad Hilton, Chad Oliver, Chris Balcom, Chris Flanagan, Chris Wainscott, Christopher Baumgartner, Christopher Chabri, Christopher Woods, I am Christoph Zalicki, a.k.a. Chess Explained, Coach J's Chess Academy, Dan O'Hanlon, Daniel Gell, Daniel Ginsburg, Daniel Lucas, Daniel Naylor, Daniel Schaefer, Daniel Vine-E, David Cramley, Dwayne Edmonds, Ethan Smith, I am Alec Donnie Ariel, Frank Tortoris, M.D., Gary Andrews, Gary Lewis, Geert Vandervelt, Gerard Barta, Giovanni Russo, I am Greg Shahadi, Harish Srinivasan, GM Jakob Ogar, James Bonastia, Jason Woolham, Jeff Anderson, Jennifer Valens of OffTheRook.com, Jeffrey Martello, John Fernandez, John Fontaine, John Hartman, John Jernigan, WGM Jen Shahadi, Jens Green, Jerry Wells, John Thompson, Kare Christensen, WGM Katerina Nemsova, Kelly Palmer, I am Kostya Kuvutsky, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Laura Belyavsky, Lucio Casada Silva, Matthew Passy, Martin Habich, Matthew Tedesco, The Mysterious Moonmaster 9000, Mr. Mike Shahadi, Nate Salon, Nathan Webster, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Passy Passanen, Paul Bain, Paul Clarkson, Paul Sweeney, Paulo Santana, Peter Lux, Peter Merrifield, Quality Chess Books, Randall Temple, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek of DiplomatChess.com, Robert Steiner, Ryan Stone, Scott Doherty, Scott McKinnon, Steiner Lima, the Law Offices of Stuart Katz, WGM Tatia Vabrahamian, Thomas Casper, Thomas Stanix, Thomas Tachenko, Tim Brennan of TacticsTime.com, Tim Seymour, Timothy Ha, Todd Bryant, Tony Rotella, Tyron Price, Victor Vrancourge, FM Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Wow, the list is getting long. Let's keep getting it longer, guys. Thanks a lot, and I'll catch you all next week.
Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.